tonight. We will start with film as usual. Steven Soderbergh's black comedy The Christophers stars Ian McKellen, who plays the role of an elderly and eccentric painter with some unscrupulous kids. Michaela Cole is an art forger. Irish director Frank Schuldeis brings us a new documentary, Once We Were Punks, which follows the rise and fall and rise again of late 80s punk act from Cavan. And we'll hear about the latest film by the Oscar-winning Hungarian director Laszlo Nemes. Orphan is about a boy in post-1956 Budapest who meets the father he never knew. To tell us what they think of the films, John McGuire and Arlene Hunt, you're both very welcome. Let's start with Steven Soderbergh, the man who over time has given us Sex, Lies and Videotape and Aaron Brockovich and the Oceans trilogy. He is back with The Christophers this time. John, where are we with Steven Soderbergh in his long career?
In the last couple of years, Soderbergh has made what are ostensibly simple, straightforward, unpretentious films, little films, if you like, usually films that bring you inside somebody's house. Kimmy, the film that he made during COVID, was a digital update on Rear Window. Presence was this kind of woozy haunted house story told from the point of view of the ghost. And The Christophers is another inside the two doors of a kind of a former faded great British artist of the 1960s. His name is Julian Sklar, and he's brilliantly played, I might say, by Ian McKellen. And he's got this house, these two houses side by side, somewhere in, we're thinking maybe Chelsea, Belgravia, somewhere like that, some part of London. Inside the front door is where we have to get, and that's where Michaela Cole's character comes in. She is an art blogger, a former artist, and an art restorer whose business has failed. And Julian's two terrible, horrible children, who are played by Jessica Gunning and James Corden, they hatch a plan to hire Michaela's character, Laurie, to get into the house, posing as Julian's assistant, get into the attic where there are seven unfinished canvases in a series called The Christophers, which were paintings that Julian did in the 1960s of his former lover. And she has to steal these canvases, unfinished canvases, hide them away, finish them in Julian's hand. She's an expert art mimic, finish them in his hand. And then when he finally pops his clogs, which everybody hopes, the two children especially, will be fairly soon, these will be rediscovered and hailed as masterpieces and sell for millions, and Laurie will get to wet her paintbrush in the loot. She'll get a cut of the proceeds. That's the first 20 minutes of the plot. Mm. I wouldn't say another word about it. I genuinely wouldn't say another word about what happens here.
Arlene,
I can't say another word about it now.
In which case, let's go straight to stars, please. It would be all too easy to believe that Ian McKellen's Julian Sklar might be old and doddery and not necessarily connected to everything happening around him, but that's not really the case here, is it?
He's not. He's, for a man of his years, both the actor and the character here, he's quite impish in his portrayal, and he's, you know, coquettish and flirty and forlorn, and he, when I say this man is wallowing in self-pity, he's like right up to the neck in muck of self-pity, but he's quite entertaining and he's quite sharp. He also knows how to use Google, because he kind of makes a lot of his money by doing these online snippets to people and then signing his name to it, or as he calls it, his lunch money. And so he's quite proficient in how to use a computer, in the day-to-day use of a computer for a man of his age, which kind of puts a spoke straight away into Laurie Butler wandering into his life as a supposed archivist assistant. Because what's the first thing he does? He's going to Google her name and see who she is. And the first thing he does when he Googles her name is he finds out who she is. So immediately this sets it up for what I would have called it a duel between the two of them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of dueling and back and forth. There's a lot of mistrust. There's a lot of blatant poking of the bear between the two. She's much more reserved, but she says an awful lot with her eyes that she doesn't need to vocalise, but he's great because he's really rolling and he's insulting on one hand and flattering on the other hand, and he pins from one conversation to another. You know, he's asking her about questions, personalised questions, and then the next breath that, you know, can you use a humidifier? And she doesn't really know where to land with this man, but it's all because he already has, you know, he's deeply suspicious of her already. She's managed to get across the doorway into this fortress house stroke studio, but now that she's in there, you don't know who's trapped with who.
let's get a sense of the relationship then between the two of them, between Ian McKellen's character Julian and Michaela Cole's Laurie. Here they are talking about a cheese omelette.
While you're out, shall I rustle us up something? A little omelette.
You're going to make me an omelette?
Don't sound so surprised.
All right, then I'll have a cheese omelette.
Yeah, cheese omelette. That's an omelette with cheese.
Yeah.
Actually, how do you introduce the cheese into the omelette? And...
I'm just going to pick something up for us, yeah?
Excellent teamwork, yeah.
If this was Schitt's Creek, there you'd go, you've got to fold it in. You've got to fold the cheese in.
John, this all presumably hinges then on the performances of both Ian McKellen and Michaela Cole,
so, yeah.
And the nature of whether or not they work together.
Well, it's a two-handed chamber piece. Once we're past the front door, it's the two of them. They're in this place, rattling around. They have to interact. He says, it's quite a talkative film, but he says a lot more than her. Michaela Cole is a very reserved actor. Like Arlene says, she just says a lot with her eyes, but it's this calm demeanor that she has, this presence that she brings to it. So he's bouncing off her quite a bit. There are twists and turns here in the story, and the scheme that the kids have laid out doesn't quite work out that way, and it's certainly not going to be that neat and tidy. But the quiet economy with which it unfolds is what's really remarkable. But they lean on the cast. Soderbergh is leaning on the cast to deliver the film. And he leans on his production designers, and he's his own cinematographer, but he leans on the camera as well. And it's the economy with which he uses all of these things which is most remarkable. I mean, there isn't a huge amount on screen, but it's incredibly busy. What he has, he makes the most of. And whatever gaps there are in the story, and we have leads in time, things move forwards, you know, in jumps, he handles that incredibly well too. And the more effortless that the film feels, and like his recent films, they do feel like they've tossed off, but they're not at all. That underneath the surface, there's a huge amount going on. And there's a real sense of that this is a film that you can explore and get busy with beyond what the surface plot and the way things are working out.
There is always with two-hander pieces like this a small danger that they can feel a little stagey or theatrical. Is there any sense of that here, Arlene?
It's Ian McKellen. Of course it's going to feel staged and theatrical. He's Gandalf, for gosh sake. You know, of course it does. Yeah. But it works for him because of the character he's playing, because this is like a Francis Bacon, Lucian Freud kind of, he's bigger than life. He was larger than life.
And he was indeed, yeah, that's
well.
The thing.
He's
yeah.
a faded grandeur. He's a faded artiste. He was in the public eye. A lot of what he says doesn't bother him, does bother him. Like the idea that he's not remembered, or that he's only remembered for the Christophers, yeah. not for other paintings. Or he's only remembered for this terrible art show that he did, which is, you know, one of those awful sky art things like that, where he was kind of critical of lots
a judge
of,
on a kind yeah, of
and he
show,
was
yeah.
awful in it. No, he admits, you know, only he was only ever thinking of the next joke that he could say, and he was kind of like the Simon Cowell of the art yeah. world for a while.
But so, it's a yeah. lovely portrait of that kind of faded celebrity. Mm. Who he used to be
yeah.
is still with him. That's the terrible curse that he has when he's rattling around in this house, is that he is haunted by who he used to be as well, and he's not that
like
person
anymore. He's a Julian Havisham in a way, because the house has fallen down around his ears as well. Like, and every, as John said, it's such a busy, because it isn't filmed over a lot of places. Like the rooms that he works in are cluttered, and it's like a proper artist studio. You know, there's yeah. old pots and there's turpentine. There's all kinds
paint
of
paint on the walls.
Everywhere,
yeah.
everywhere.
Yeah, it's very Bacon-y. Very, very Bacon-esque.
Very Bacon-y.
Yeah, very Bacon-esque.
Okay,
yeah.
We're going to go to stars, please, Arlene.
I gave it a solid four out of five.
John. Oh, yeah, a solid four, too. This is very entertaining. That's the thing. And the two of them are superb. And Michaela Cole is a brilliant, brilliant actor. And Ian McKellen is Ian McKellen. Yeah,
okay.
Four stars. Go see it.
Next up is a really interesting new documentary directed by Frank Schuldeis. It's about a punk band formed in the 1980s by four school friends. 25 years after the Panic Merchants disbanded, they met at a funeral, and to all of their surprise, they picked up where they left off to form the Sons of Southern Ulster. Arlene, there's a lot going on in this, so tell us about it.
Okay, so we meet them initially, the four lads, and we meet them initially. There's Noel Larkin, Justin Kelly, David Marr, and Paddy Glacken, who's then replaced in the band by young Rory, who, as it turns out then, is David Marr's son. So they start off, and it's very much of how they came together as kids. You know, this is the 80s in Cavan, and the town that they lived in was quite, as they said, it was quite an up-and-coming town. There was a smelting and there was a little market area, and it was really busy, and two of the lads didn't really feel like they fit in. So they had that kind of, you know, typical kind of little misfits thing, but they all kind of clicked along together and they got along with each other, and that's why they decided to come up with their first punk rock band, you know, from Cavan. And they say themselves that they took it quite seriously for a while and then they didn't. And then it kind of waned away as they got into their 20s. They never quite hit, you know, the hopeful stardom that they were hoping to get to. They were like, they were leaning towards a Clash type thing, and it didn't happen that way. So they got a little bit older. They got into their 20s, and as life happens when they got into their 20s, you know, two lads went abroad. One went to Boston, one went to Western Australia. The lads got married. Life went on. And I think it was Justin Kelly's mom who passed away, and the lads all came back for her funeral. And when they were back at the funeral, they reconnected again, and they just almost kind of fell into their roles as men, but as their boyhood roles, but as men. And they started to start, hey, maybe we should never have given up this band idea. Maybe there's more to it. And this is where it kicks off into the second half.
Okay, let's remind people what Bailieborough, County Cavan was like in the 1980s. You're going to hear a clip from the band's singer, Justin Kelly, who is the son of the late Captain James Kelly, a central figure in the 1970 Irish arms trial.
Across the street is where I grew up. It was a pub that my father bought in the 1970s, the West End Bar. And it was a pub, in fact, that his father had owned before him. And we'd sort of come down from Dublin. We'd sort of hit hard times in many ways. And we were sort of rebuilding our lives here. And it was a busy spot. We used to have music, and we had a jukebox and a pool table and a slot machine. And I had a Space Invaders machine and all that stuff. So, you know, it was everything a boy could really want. And drink and fags behind the counter and crisps as well.
When I was a boy, I served drink to men. I served drink to Roaring Johnny on the night that he passed. Trampled above in the byre.
And we lived upstairs. In fact, if you look up there, that window there on the left, the dormer window, that was my bedroom. So I'd sort of sit out there smoking cigarettes out the window and listening to music and planning my eventual getaway.
I mean, John, it's not just a nostalgic look at a lost series of childhoods. It's very celebratory about Cavan, about rural Ireland in general.
Celebratory, I don't know. It's very observational. Justin Kelly has a real eye for and a real sense of the poetry of the place, which is a rural town. And a lot of his lyrics are based on his father, Captain James Kelly's advice. He was told, you know, don't be writing about things that you don't know, right? What you know. And so he wrote stories about the characters, the places, the little spots they used to go to, the people, and a kind of a feeling of frustration with Ireland in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And he you know, the songs, at the time they were called Panic Merchants. And, you know, when they went to Dublin for a few gigs, they released an EP. They were on a compilation record, you know, they were playing some decent gigs, but that big break never quite materialised for them. And in the second iteration of the band, the Sons of Southern Ulster, the songs are informed, let's say, by their previous lack of success. And I think the great message in the film, which is it's never too late to be creative. There is an outlet for you, regardless of your age. These are all men in their mid-50s by the time we catch up with them in this film. And that you can keep going and keep doing it. And your work is, your thoughts are valid, your songs are valid, your music has an audience. You know, they get offered this gig at the Saturday night on the main stage in Whelan's, which is not a small gig, one of the prime music spots in the country. And the second half of the film is about rehearsing and performing and coming down from afterwards, the high of that gig. But there's multiple story arcs to follow here, this personal and creative. Centered on these four friends reconnecting in order to face the old demons and face up to some new ones, because there are touches of personal news, which we won't spoil here, that are in the film as well.
Arlene, is this more about a lament for the lost youth that they had, or do you feel this is about celebrating their middle age?
They don't lament their loss, though. That's the thing. They're very philosophical about it. They were asked by the producer, you know, were you sorry that you didn't go on with your gigs and your music at the time, when in the 80s, when you were young lads? Are you sorry you didn't? And they're all pretty much in agreement that they weren't sorry. And if they had kept going, they would have fallen out and fallen out hard, probably, because they were young lads with the young lad energy and the young lad ego and all the rest of it. And when they get back in their 50s, life has given them a different view of things and a different patience and a different energy. So when they get back to playing again, as you know, the sons of Southern Ulster, they have a very different approach to it. They take it much more seriously for a start as well. David Marr in particular is
a lot of rehearsing.
Is a they lot rehearse, of rehearsing. Really, and he's very, and he's also, yeah, he also really improved in his guitar work, and he puts a lot of effort into production. Yeah, yeah. And he takes it so seriously that they also take it quite seriously. Yeah, yeah. So this is not a young man's game any longer. This is an older man's game, and they know how to play it.
We're going to have a listen now to how the band got their more recent name, the Sons of Southern Ulster. Justin Kelly is speaking again, and there is some strong language in the following clip.
When I think of writings of Cavan, it's always this kind of somber kind of, oh, the hills and the rain, but never this level of detail about these characters that actually existed. So it seemed important to me to sort of write about that. Cavan was kind of the forgotten county in Ireland, and hence the name Sons of Southern Ulster that we came up with. That was very much a nod to this, that Cavan and Monaghan and Donegal, the three counties that the Brits didn't want and the Irish didn't give a shit about. I began to go down that sort of path, that lyrical path of like looking at this sort of rural existence that we live through.
Okay, let's go to stars on this. John.
Look, I think it's a fine film. Frank Sholdes is a good filmmaker. And back in Cavan after The Man Who Wanted to Fly, it was a really interesting documentary. But this is, to me, a film about how youth culture used to be subdivided and isn't anymore. That we now get this homogenous mass where everything is the same. Whereas before we had punks and rockers and new romantics and cure heads and whatever it might have been. And it was a much more interesting time. And it's a record of that richer cultural stew and about how bands have individual and collective identities, but the identity is the thing. And I that really came across for me. So it's a 4-star film. For me, I really enjoyed it. There's a line in it, stop trying to impress people, just do your own thing. I thought that they should put that on the poster, and they should put a poster in every school. That's because it's just such a mass right now. And this is a time when it wasn't. It was fractured and divided and much more exciting.
You've reminded me that I want to be a cure head. I just wasn't brave enough. Eileen, please, stars.
Like John, there was a line in it where they get onto stage in Whelan. He goes, there's a lot of people here. Justin Kelly said, there's a lot of people here. Are you sure you're in the right place?
Yeah, it's a good line.
And it made me laugh out loud because these guys are great. These guys, you'd happily be friends with these lads or sit down and listen to them play a gig. They're fun. I gave it a 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, Orphan is the latest film by Laszlo Nemes. It tells the story of a young boy finding his way amid the aftermath of the failed Hungarian uprising against the Soviet regime in the 1950s. John, tell us a little bit more about where we are here.
Oof, Laszlo Nemes, no, this is not to be taken lightly. None of his films are. His first film was Son of Saul. He won the second prize at Cannes. He won an Oscar for Son of Saul, which is a Holocaust film, Second World War. His follow-up, Sunrise, was set in Hungary in the year before the start of the First World War. It was kind of a tremulous thing. It followed a young woman working in a hat shop. Very dense, very beautifully filmed, as all of his films are, but quite dense and difficult. And here's another one, another somber war drama set in, we're back in Budapest in 1957. Before, during and after these world changing conflicts, that seems to be Nemes' real place where he's most comfortable. And it's a story from his own family history to, again, try to gauge the reverberations of the shock waves that were going on and try to personalize them, I suppose, is what he's trying to do. And in his own family, as a youngster, Nemes' father was told that the man that he believed to be his father, Nemes' grandfather, was not really his father. And it was a revelation that caused a trauma that never left the man. He was always haunted by this secret identity that he had. And from that point, Nemes and his screenwriter, Clara Royer, it's a coming-of-age story, I suppose, centered on this young Jewish boy, Andor, who's played by Bjorten Barabbas. And he's making the same life-altering discovery among the rubble of Budapest after the war. Him and his mother, Clara, who's played by Andrea Vaskovits, they are doing whatever they can to survive. She's working in a shop. He's hanging out with the kids on the bomb sites. And the relationship is pretty strained because Clara had left him in an orphanage when he was a baby because she was Jewish and she had to hide. And she comes back to collect him at the start of the film. And now it faces, the relationship again faces another fatal blow because the arrival of this arrogant and brutish butcher named Berend, played by Gregory Gadebois, he's a French actor, who the boy eventually figures out, he's never told, but eventually figures out is his real father and not this long dead,
idealized
hero, idealized guy of his imagination. And together with his only friend, who's Sari, is played by Les Sabo, who's hiding her brother, who's this rebel from the communists. He stages these kind of small revolutions of his own, just to try, he's acting out, I suppose, is what you would say, because he really doesn't know who he is or where he is or what's going on.
So not easy material, potentially, Arlene. What did you make of it?
Well, it's not sunshines and lollipops, I can tell you that. It's quite grim. It's grim where they live. It's grim how they're treated. At one point, the Moscow police, the Soviet police, pick him up in the streets for doing nothing except just being a 13-year-old boy. And they bring him to the, you know, the police station, and they could really have given him quite a hard time. But his mom arrives down pretty quickly to collect him and has to debase herself and humiliate herself to a certain degree to take him from there and make sure that his safety, which is paramount to her, which he resents in a lot of ways, but his safety, you know, she will put herself on the line and has put herself on the line so many ways through this movie to protect him, but he doesn't understand because he's 13 and he resents her, he resents this man who intrudes upon his life. It should be said that Gadebois, he's really menacing in this film.
Yeah, he's really scary.
He's like
yeah.
a French Tony Soprano. You know, he's a big man, he breathes heavily, he moves
quick,
heavily,
yeah,
but he's light on his feet. He's exactly the kind of person that makes you very nervous, but he has a momentary moments of kindness in him, but at the same time he's very if you're a 13-year-old boy, a little 13-year-old boy, and this monster lumbers into your life, it's going to be terrifying, and it is terrifying. So this is quite it's quite a heavy film in a lot of ways. It's also for me a little bit too long, and that sort of annoyed me, but you know, because it's so relentlessly grim, you know, but it goes on and on and on and on and on, and after a while you just get tired of it. You just get tired of how awful it is for everyone.
He has a really unique...
I would kind of say the same thing, but in different language. I totally agree with what Arlene has just said. Yeah, there's a gravity here that the characters cannot escape. That, and what's worse is, this is a sad story, but there is a well of sadness that the whole thing is so sad that they struggle to differentiate from all the horrible things that are going on. This is just another awful thing that's going on, and particularly for a story that's from his own family history, it's kind of sluggish and strangely unmoving. I mean, I never got a good reason to care about this kid when there's all this other stuff to care about and this awful situation. And then you think, right, 1957, they've got another 30 years of this to go. That approach, that it's just another sad story, and the seismic events that are destroying this family are constantly eclipsed by this violent and impoverished place that they're in. It's one cannot separate from the other, and it's really frustrating to watch.
Okay, how many stars then, please, John?
3 for me. It is beautifully photographed. All of Nemesis films. He is an extraordinary cinema. He has an extraordinary sense of cinema, but it's unevenly paced and kind of sluggish. So 3 for me, 3 stars.
Okay, Arlene.
I gave it 3 as well. I just think it had a lot more potential than it was allowed to have. I just think it was so heavy-handed, and from this very start to the very end, no little moment at all, or no spark of where you can see the humanity, or any spark where you can think, oh, maybe if they make this decision, that will be a good decision. So but I'll give it a solid 3.
Thank you very much, John McGuire and Arlene Hunt. The Christophers and When We Were Punks are on general release. Orphan is in selected cinemas.
Arena on RTE Radio 1.
And you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. The West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival takes place next week from Wednesday the 20th to Sunday the 24th, bringing an exciting programme of chamber music, jazz and family events to venues in and around Blessington. The performers include singer, songwriter and producer China Moses, an artist who's been releasing music and performing across the globe for nearly 30 years. Her voice has been described as a satin ribbon wrapped around a crackling flame, and China Moses joins me on the line now. You're very welcome to Arena.
Hi, how you doing?
they weren't wrong about your voice. You have a new album out, China, called It's Complicated. I'm going to get to that in a minute. But first of all, I've seen you being categorised as a jazz singer, and I know you're not overly happy with labels. Do you call yourself jazz adjacent?
I am jazz adjacent. I mean, I'm a jazz singer for people who may not know what a jazz singer is, I guess, which is fine. You know, you got to be something for somebody.
You've said that the jazz community has a hard time letting artists exist beyond the boundaries of jazz and just being seen as creators of art. Do you think there's a reason for that?
You know, I think it is because the people who wrote about what jazz is put it in boundaries that weren't existent actually and didn't want to really acknowledge that jazz is primarily infused with multiple rhythms, multiple heritages. And, you know, the same people who play in church are the same people who will make the jazz. And I think that it comes from a direct disregard actually from of the wideness of Black American culture as a whole.
There are a group of people who would tend to see jazz as being something that exists almost as if it's frozen in time and there's nothing happening in jazz post 1967, which obviously isn't true.
Yeah, pretty much.
How do you react to that? How do you react to that as a contemporary singer?
Well, I just consider that jazz that those people are referring to was the pop music of their time. But my grandmother, my mom's mom, was a great fan of Johnny Mathis. And I remember her loving the album that that Johnny Mathis did back, I think it was in the 70s. He went to Philadelphia and did something with Philadelphia Records, which was very soulful. It was still his voice. It was still the Johnny Mathis crooner that we know. But he was singing some things that are a little more soul adjacent, I would say. And I just believe that putting jazz in this box that only spans, you know, 30 years is reductive to what it is. It's a living art form. It's a way of life. It's a way of seeing the world and a way of bringing your heritage into this music that has a common ground. It was made and created in New Orleans. And you can find every kind of music in New Orleans, and there's a jazz for everyone.
Let's have a listen to something of yours. This is a track called I Can Be Happy, I Can Be Blue.
Such a delicate situation.
That is from the new album from China Moses called It's Complicated. It's called I Can Be Happy, I Can Be Blue. China Moses is with me. Tell me about the new album. It's Complicated is a great name for an album. Talk to me about that and about how the album came about.
Well, I sincerely believe that if we all accepted that life is complicated, we would be less surprised when life makes hard turns. And also, I just couldn't find a title for the album. And then also, when people ask me what kind of music I make, I kind of change the definition depending on who I'm speaking to. Because it is complicated. For so many years, we separated jazz from the blues, from the soul, from the funk, from the gospel, from the R&B, from the country, from the folk, from the rock, you know? And I think that separation diminishes the greatness and the diversity of Black American music as a whole. So that's why I called the album It's Complicated, because life is complicated, and that's okay by me.
It's fair to say that you're not a fan of having your music on streaming platforms. Why is that?
Well, this album, I decided to not put it on the main streaming platforms because I, as an artist, had to make a decision of what kind of artist I wanted to be entering this era of AI and the dominance of streaming platforms and playlisting and all these conversations that have people stressed out for no reason. I'm a live artist, first and foremost. I tour. It's a lifestyle. I'm always on tour. And it's what I love doing, and it's a vocation. So I figured that if I put all this love and all these people help me make and craft this album, this piece of audio art, that it deserved to exist on its own in a way. I'm not trying to sell records. I don't make money from selling records. I pay my rent with concerts. And that's an honest exchange, you know? The album itself is more for the person who wants to have an active listening moment. I think bringing back that intentional listening is really important nowadays.
Side A and side B is important. It's fair to say that you come from a gifted family. Your mother's the legendary jazz singer Dee Dee Bridgewater. Your father was the actor, director and activist Gilbert Moses. What was it like growing up with parents like that?
It was having lots of aunties and uncles that were quite eccentric and pretty cool. No complaints. I have lived an extraordinary life in the sense that, you know, I didn't have parents that had 9-to-5s. Well, sometimes they did, but I just know a life filled with art and people who believed in the power of art and the transcending and transformative nature of art. So I grew up in a special world and a very privileged world in that sense. It was great. My parents are cool. I have no complaints.
Did you get specific advice from your mom over the years, given that the two of you have similar careers?
Well, my mom is like my bestie, and she's the one who pushed me into music. I didn't particularly want to be an artist. She's the one who said that I had something. I had that thing. I don't still know what that thing is, but apparently it's working out for me. But the best advice my mom gave me when I was starting out is that I can only be me. She said, rule number one, if you're going to sing a classic, a standard, sing the original melody first and then try to make it your own. And always try to sing the words as if they were your words. Rule number two, always be nice to the audience and to the people who organize these events, these festivals, these concerts, you know, because it's a labor of love and passion. And number three, always make sure that your musicians are well fed. I've lived by those rules. It's worked out for me.
I can imagine that goes a long way. For people
who, it does.
For people who are going to come and see your set next week at the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival, what should they expect?
They should expect an evening of song. I'm a singer-songwriter first and foremost, so it's songs. And depending on who I'm playing with, my songs can take on a different nature. So they can expect some blues and some jazz and a little bit of R&B and soul and a lot of storytelling. I like telling stories in between songs. I feel like it's important to set the scene, set the tone. You know, it's like a stage play almost. You know, the music for me is not enough. The fact that my musicians are superb, that is a given. Okay. If I'm anywhere, know that my band is amazing. If you don't like me, you'll like my band. But first, you know, I just want people to feel involved, you know, and for them to enter my world of song and of stories.
China Moses, thanks so much for joining us on Arena tonight. We're going to finish it with another track from It's Complicated. But it's been brilliant talking to you. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Rick. And you have a wonderful voice also.
I was going to play the song anyway. This is China Moses from It's Complicated. And it's one called My Part of Town for Mama. That's China Moses from It's Complicated. It's called My Part of Town for Mama. You can see her performing at the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival in the Tramway Theatre, Blessington, on Saturday, May 23rd. You can find details at westwicklowfestival.com. Her new album is available to download from her website, chinamoses.com.
Arena on RTE Radio 1.
We often say that food is a universal language, but for my next guest, it's also a time machine, a bridge between cultures and a profound act of survival. Hannah Khalil is an acclaimed Irish-Palestinian playwright and screenwriter. Growing up between the heat of Dubai and childhood summers in a cottage in Kilkenny, she developed a unique dual perspective. Her plays frequently explore the immigrant experience, the resilience of women, and the complex realities of starting over. Recently, her play My English Persian television kitchen has been captivating audiences by quite literally cooking on stage. By filling the theatre with the real simmering aromas of traditional Iranian stews, the play tells the true story of a woman who rebuilds her life and community in a new country through the recipes of her homeland. Hannah will take part in International Literature Festival Dublin, where she will be contributing to a fascinating panel next Saturday, May 16th, entitled Stirring the Pot, an exploration of the complex relationship between creative practice, conflict and food. Hannah, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you so much for having me.
Having spent summers in a cottage in Kilkenny and the rest of the year in Dubai, and that's some contrast, how did that dual perspective shape your ear for storytelling, do you think?
Well, I always loved spinning a yarn, particularly when I was at home in Ireland, because most of the other children hadn't been to the Middle East and didn't really know much about it. So they'd ask me whether I lived in a tent or rode on a camel. And I, of course, would tell the most horrendous lies and have great fun with it. So that was probably the beginning of my my storytelling, I would imagine. Yeah.
Did that ever happen in the opposite direction then when you went to Dubai?
Less so, because I was at an international school, but I would tell stories about the fairies that I would encounter in the woods. I was always a great fan of Irish folklore, and actually at the moment I'm adapting a classic Irish children's book for film, and it's bringing me such great joy because it's a book I read as a child. So yes, it works in both directions.
Are you allowed to tell us which one?
Yes, it's called Hounds of the Morrigan. It's a really fantastic book that was written in the 80s by a writer called Pat O'Shea. And I read it, my mum read it to me when I was a child, and I've wanted to adapt it for years. And I'm now working with a wonderful producer, Mammoth Island, on making it a reality with funding from Screen Ireland. So I'm really excited about it.
Oh, that's a hugely well-known book. That's very exciting. Following your parents' divorce, though, you moved to London with your Irish mother, and you've mentioned that your main connection to your Palestinian father's heritage became the dishes that he cooked. So how vital was that in keeping that particular part of your identity alive?
Absolutely vital. And it's kind of strange. Mum would make boiled bacon and cabbage frequently, but the only other thing that she really cooked was a dish called makluba, which in Arabic means upside down. It's sort of layers of rice and cauliflower and aubergine. I mean, you get into a fight with other Palestinians about what should be in it, because village by village, you have your own recipe. But Mum was a dab hand at doing it. And the way you serve it is you turn the pot upside down and then lift it up. It's quite a sort of celebratory and sort of theatrical dish in itself. And so she used to cook that a lot for us as well. And yeah, it's unusual, I think, that she would be, you know, my Irish mum would be cooking her ex-husband's food, but she loved it so much.
Your recent play, My English Persian Kitchen, it's based on the true story of a two-sister affair who fled Iran for London. What was it about her journey that then clicked with your own family's history?
So when I was approached to write this play that's inspired by Atuza's story, I was reluctant at first because, of course, I'm not Iranian and I've never been to Iran. So I thought, oh, maybe I'm not the right person. But once I met Atuza and started talking to her, I realized that the story wasn't about Iran. It was about starting again. And essentially, that's what my mum had to do, because she lived in Dubai for a really long time. And then when my parents divorced and she returned to London, she had to start again from nothing and build community from nothing. And I thought, well, I know what that story is and I know what that's like. So that became a very strong kind of connector for me to Atuza and her story.
Yeah, she spoke to us about that on the programme quite recently, and you can find that wherever you find your usual podcasts. The play doesn't just talk about food. It has live cooking of, and I'm going to mangle this, but I will do my best, ashe reshte, a traditional Iranian noodle stew. Thank you. What does filling a theatre with the physical aroma of a simmering stew, what does that do to the audience's experience?
I think smells are just not used often enough in theatre, because it's a live art form, and we never use that sense. And it really draws people in a different way and creates a really visceral response to the work, I think. And when we did the show at the Traverse in Edinburgh, it was a great way of getting people in, because they'd be up in the bar and they'd smell these smells and say, oh, are they serving food here? And everyone would say, no, it's the show downstairs. So people then would be hankering for a ticket to get a taste of the food.
You've compared theatre to cooking insofar as, you know, both are about gathering a group of people together to share an intimate experience. Do you see that act of offering food as a universal language that bypasses all sorts of barriers and borders between people?
Absolutely. We all sit down and eat, and there's no greater act of love than cooking for somebody. And, you know, both my cultures, Palestinian and Irish, the most generous people in the world on both sides, and, you know, would always welcome you to sit at the table and break bread together. And I think it's a really beautiful thing to do, and to create opening and conversation. And that play really did that, because at the end of the show, people would all get to taste this stew, and the conversations were just extraordinary. A young woman came and spoke to me and said, I've never been to Iran, I'm Icelandic, but watching this play made me feel homesick. You know, it's that universal thing of missing home, and how do you get there without getting there, without traveling there. That's food is a really, really great way to do that.
You're appearing at the International Literature Festival in Dublin this weekend. It's for a panel titled Stirring the Pot, along with Roxana Manocheri and Bojana Jankovic. What sort of conversation are you hoping that's going to spark with the audience?
I'm just really excited to see what people bring in terms of their experiences of food and travel and memory, and how food can stimulate different things. And I'm always open to kind of interesting stories, because all of us writers are magpies. So you never know what I'll take away and put into my pot and stir and make something new.
I'm interested in that we usually associate cooking with comfort, with domesticity, but the ILF event is exploring food and conflict. So how do you think the act of making a traditional dish can become a political statement or even an act of protest, for instance?
Well, in places where culture is being erased, like Palestine, you know, it's very important to remember. And, you know, this is the other thing that Tuja and I have in common. It's very tricky for me to go back to the West Bank where my family live. And it's really tricky for Atuza to go back to Iran. And so how do we do it? We make the food. And I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I'm like, how do I pass on her Palestinian heritage? How do I give her some of that? And how do I talk about that? And we spend a lot of time baking Palestinian different kind of baked goods and cooking together and making pastries and all sorts. And it's a really lovely tradition to pass on, but it absolutely an act of resistance when your culture is being erased, as well as the actual human beings being erased as well.
There's an element of that a recipe like that can frequently be the only archive a displaced person gets to keep sometimes. And that's not necessarily something that people understand well, is it?
That's right. And it's it's also very female, you know, it's a very female oral tradition. And there's something also about cooking and the stories you tell while you cook about whose recipe it was, where it came from. As I was saying about makluba, like how different people would make it. And that's a very, very, very female way of telling a story and passing a history, I think. Yeah.
You've a new show coming up called Love Omar, centred on Omar Sharif's 1983 British stage experience. I want to ask, how true is it that you credit Omar Sharif and Dr. Zhivago with your parents meeting and thus, I mean, with your very existence?
I have to say it's true. So mum went to London to study nursing when she was 16, and ended up at a party where my dad was. My dad had been working in a hotel, and he had just been kicked out of his digs, and he was looking for somewhere to stay. And he said to my mum, "Is there anywhere at your place?" And mum said, "Oh, I think the place upstairs is free." And he sort of asked her to immediately phone the landlady, and he stood in front of her, and the landlady said, "What's he like?" And mum said, "Oh, he looks nice." And is he clean? And mum said, "He looks clean." He said, "What do you mean I look clean? I am clean." Anyway, he got the room, and she was duly invited up to the room. And somehow on a single hob, he managed to cook something. I don't know what, but some Palestinian meal. And of course, she had with her her roommate, you know, just to keep an eye and make sure that nothing untoward happened. But my mum was much more adventurous than her friend. And her friend apparently opened her purse in her lap and just spooned all the food into her handbag and ruined her handbag. But mum had seen Dr. Zhivago about 50 times. And my dad bears a passing resemblance, the moustache, the eyes. So I do think it's because of him that I exist, yeah.
As I understand it, you're currently developing new work with the Abbey and with the Gate Theatres as well. I mean, what's it like for you creatively then to be able to bring your craft back to Ireland and to the country that holds so many of your childhood memories?
I can't tell you how much it means to be working in Ireland. I'm so happy about it. It's something I've wanted to do for such a long time. And I think the way that I tell stories, so much of it is linked to the stories that my granny in Kilkenny used to tell. And as I say, like the Irish folklore. And so to have the opportunity and the work that's being made at the moment in Ireland, I think is extraordinary, second to none. So I feel very proud that I'm having that opportunity to develop work, and hopefully it'll be on the stages at some point in the not too distant future.
For the event at International Literature Festival Dublin this weekend, is there going to be any cooking involved or just talking about cooking?
Just chat, I'm afraid, as far as I know. I mean, but if any of the audience want to bring me things to try, I'm always happy to eat.
I think that's a challenge. Hannah Khalil, thank you so much for talking to us tonight on Arena.
I'm absolutely delighted. Thank you for having me.
You can find out more details about Hannah's event Stirring the Pot at ILF Dublin this coming Saturday at ilfdublin.com.